Hello, this is The New World, a podcast produced by Reaction, exploring the world after the coronavirus crisis. I'm Jack Dickens, International Editor at Reaction. The New World Order is being reshaped all around us. The liberal ideals which triumphed at the end of the Cold War now confront new challenges. The US-China rivalry and the coronavirus pandemic have disrupted international relations, and a backlash against globalization is changing the world economy. So, are we witnessing the dawn of a new age in global politics? And what kind of international order will emerge from the coronavirus crisis? With me to discuss these questions on the podcast today are Mette Aelstrup Sangiovanni, reader in international relations at the University of Cambridge, and Ian Martin, editor of Reaction and columnist at The Times. So, Mette, has the coronavirus pandemic thrown global politics into crisis?
Well, the pandemic has thrown global politics into crisis, I think, by further straining relations between Beijing and Washington, by triggering an economic downturn in many parts of the world, and by disrupting ongoing diplomatic processes like the review conference of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, for instance. But I think it would be incorrect to say that the pandemic has thrown the liberal international order into crisis. One might argue that COVID has exacerbated certain aspects of an ongoing crisis of liberal internationalism and order. But I think we must be careful in specifying what specific aspects of that order are currently under threat. When speaking of liberal order, many invoke values like democracy, market capitalism, and US hegemony. To my mind, the global order is narrower than that, the global order as we've known it in the post-war years. It rests, I think, on three foundational principles. Firstly, respect for national sovereignty and principles of sovereign equality. Secondly, on economic openness. And thirdly, on multilateralism, that is, rule-based cooperation through international institutions and subject to sanction by rule of international law. Now, in the past decade, many scholars have claimed that specifically the multilateral aspect of the global order is in crisis. This is reflected in growing contestation and deadlock within major international organizations, in exit from multilateral fora and so forth. But in this dimension, I think it's simply too early to claim any direct effects of COVID. Yes, the US has cut funding to the World Health Organization. Trump has formally begun the process of American withdrawal, but many other countries have instead rallied around the WHO and called for strengthening its powers and reversing previous budget cuts. As for Trump's attack on multilateral organizations, this, of course, predates COVID. Even before the crisis, the US had reduced its contribution to the WHO and to many UN agencies. As for formal withdrawal from international organizations, this too fits a general pattern. Since the 2000s, the US has withdrawn from a number of both bilateral and multilateral agreements. Indeed, Washington has a long history, you might say, of declining to join and of withdrawing from international organizations. Now, withdrawal, of course, may speed up to some extent the decline of US hegemony, but none of this, I think, amounts to a crisis of multilateralism or liberal order as such. In fact, I think it's worth pointing out that recent studies of international treaty withdrawal show that exit from international agreements is not definitely increasing. We have seen a few high-profile cases that have attracted a lot of attention, but while there is a slight increase in the total number of treaty withdrawals, this must be seen in the context of a rapidly growing number of international treaties overall and, of course, of increasing numbers of state parties.
So I think what you raised really well there, Mette, is that it's very hard to know what is going to happen when you're in the middle of a period of crisis and upheaval. Ian, you know, if this is a crisis, who is it a crisis for and what are the consequences going to be?
Well, I think Mette put it very well in terms of this has sped up developments which were already happening. You know, if you look back, I've just come off a call where we were discussing global politics in the context of what happened to the notion of BRICS Does everyone remember what BRICS are? You know, which was Brazil and China and Russia, who were the sort of new, who were the new emerging force in politics. And we all had to go to presentations 10, 15 years ago explaining to us how globalization was going to rebalance the world economy. Look what's happened since to Brazil. Look what's happening with Russia and then with China. You went back 10 years ago and said, look, there'll be a great crisis and it will bring to a head a dispute between the US and China and the West more generally. And China, people have said, well, that's not the way in which history is developing. China is becoming more liberal. And actually, what happened in 2012 with the change of regime, the change of leadership, has taken China in a different direction. And it's taken the crisis, I mean, back towards something closer towards totalitarianism, aided by technology. But the crisis is forcing us to confront these changes. It might, without COVID-19, it might have taken us another decade in terms of policy development and awakening, but it's happened in 10 weeks or so rather than 10 years. The consequences then, which I'm sure we'll come on to talk about in terms of shortening of supply chains, reordering of how the world works, I think that's all in flux and up for debate in the months and years ahead.
So you think that rather than this being a crisis per se, what we're experiencing really is a period of uncertainty, and that this uncertainty is part of perhaps a correction about what was going before, a correction against certain elements of global politics, whether it was the period of hyper-globalization, what we might call hyper-globalization, which was experienced after the Cold War.
Yeah.
This has kind of corrected some of the simplistic assumptions we had about how politics works.
I was a skeptic about it in that I'm an advocate of, I don't like nationalism, but I like patriotism. And I spent the 90s and the early 2000s feeling instinctively that the notion that the nation state was dead and was going to sort of gradually just be evaporated by history and by the emergence of a globalized approach. And globalization, of course, is not new. The Victorians thought in those terms as well. So I was a skeptic about that. So I have to be aware of confirmation bias. So if I say that globalization is being revealed as, you know, as having some serious flaws, I thought it had flaws all along. You know, I was at the Nice summit in where you had the beginnings of the kind of anti-globalization demonstrations and Genoa and all of that in the early 2000s. So this has been brewing. The backlash has been brewing for a long time. I think I'm in favor of free trade and free movement of capital and global markets, but I just think that there was a hubris post the end of the Cold War, which led people to think that we were on this conveyor belt towards this kind of utopian globalized world, and we've been reminded by history, which makes fools of us in the end, that the progress towards that is not going to be straightforward. And I think the nation state reasserting itself is the story of the last 10 years.
Meta, is this a crisis of globalization, do you think, or is there another layer to this problem we're experiencing now?
I think there's definitely another layer. I agree very much with what Ian just said in terms of bringing certain vulnerabilities and problems and dangers entailed in hyper-globalization into sharper focus. But I think it's too soon and wrong, frankly, to think that the crisis necessarily is causing a backlash against globalization. For now, of course, some of the responses to the virus has entailed important curbs on globalization in the form of tightening of borders and the restriction of trade and travel and so on. And these have been necessary short-term measures. But the big question is whether the ongoing public health crisis will trigger a more general backlash, leading to a shortening of supply chains, leading to preference given to domestic goods in order to decrease dependence on foreign countries and so on. And here I think the signs are much less clear. If anything, you could argue the crisis is showing us how deeply the world depends on cross-border trade and cooperation in order to meet just essential medical needs. Masks, ventilators, protective equipment, this can all be produced domestically in the long run, to be sure. But the development of effective vaccines, state-of-the-art medical equipment, understanding what a crisis such as this one entails in public health terms, none of this can be achieved by nations in isolation. So We have also, in a sense, seen the crisis highlight the need for continued globalization, if you will. Joseph Stiglitz recently argued in an article that although the cross-border movement of goods and people has clearly plummeted since the beginning of this year, the pandemic also seems to be driving a more digitalized form of globalization where information and exchange of knowledge is flowing as fast, if not faster than ever before. So no, I don't think for now that the crisis is necessarily causing a backlash against globalization. But of course, the real test, as Ian says, comes down the line. A lot will depend on how the international system copes with the long-term economic fallout from the crisis. If much of the world falls into economic recession or depression, then the long-term consequences may be much more severe, insofar as we know that economic crises tend to breed populism, then we may see further democratic backsliding. While, as I said a minute ago, democracy is neither necessary nor sufficient for sustaining global order or indeed globalization, we do know that populist governments tend to be less reliable international partners, less likely to respect international law, more prone to stoke anti-globalization sentiment for short-term political gain. So that could indeed cause a longer-term backlash against globalization.
Ian, do you have something to add there?
It's difficult to know because historians won't know for 20, 30 years whether COVID was the sort of the middle of a Western crisis or the culmination of a Western crisis. I mean, I would trace it back to 9/11. If you think of it in terms of with thinking about the future of the West, 9/11 bleeding into the Iraq War, bleeding into the financial crisis, bleeding into what we've just seen with COVID. If you take that, the first 15 to 20 years of the 21st century have not been an unalloyed success for the West. I think, say that someone who is an advocate of Western civilization and the good that it has to contribute, but it's not been an unalloyed success. So we don't quite know whether this is the middle of a 40-year or 50-year unraveling of the West, or whether the West will be able to reinvent itself after it. I think on the globalization front, I often think of this in terms of an institution like Davos. And if we're wondering where the backlash came from, or why electorates started to intrinsically in countries like Britain resent the notion of a globalized elite, I think it has to do with the financial crisis at its heart. And I think it is connected to the idea that post the fall of the Berlin Wall, a globalized economic elite strengthened its position. And all the signals were, you don't need to worry about economics. Economics is now settled. We settled that above the nation state, with very clever people wearing very similar suits and speaking at very similar conferences, promoting the same values. So economics is now settled, and we don't have financial crises in the same way anymore. We know what we're doing at a central bank and global corporate banking level. And then a crisis happened in 2007, 2008. And lo and behold, when the bill fell for that, it didn't fall with the global elite who said that they had everything sorted. It fell on national taxpayers. So I think people made that connection. They knew that they were then paying the bill for what had gone wrong with the financial system. And I'd stress again, I'm in favor of global financial capitalism and free movement of capital within sensible regulated limits. But I think voters are not daft. And I think they worked out that a lot of what they'd been told in the years running up to the financial crisis was hokum, and we're still seeing the effects of that play out. It was a contributory factor, I think, in Brexit. I don't have the answer to this, but just pose the question is, if you think that the West has done really badly has responded badly to 9/11, the financial crisis has then been a huge, huge headache, and now then COVID, can the West regroup? What are its organizing principles? A lot then obviously depends on the results of the presidential election in November. Does America show leadership? If it's not America, is it possible for leadership to come from somewhere else? I don't know.
I'm glad you brought up the forthcoming presidential election, Ian, because this raises the question, doesn't it, again, of what role does the USA have in providing global leadership for our international system? And Meta, this is something you've written a lot about. We just found out that Donald Trump is going to be formally withdrawing from the World Health Organization, and this comes on the back of a number of high-profile withdrawals from international institutions. Is this something we should be worried about?
Well, many scholars, American scholars in particular, unsurprisingly perhaps, have regarded the post-war order as more or less synonymous with American hegemony. I think that in taking for granted the necessity of American power and leadership to effective multilateral cooperation, they've somewhat misrepresented, you might say, what multilateralism broadly and liberal internationalism specifically is really fundamentally about. Bob Cohen argued many years ago in his book After Hegemony that hegemonic leadership, a supreme power, is useful for facilitating the creation of international institutions, but that once these institutions are in place and are offering mutually rewarding cooperation, then other states can often step up to the plate and provide the leadership necessary to sustain that cooperation and to shape it. And this, I think, is broadly what we've seen, not just lately, but basically going back to the 1980s, where other states have increasingly been proposing and creating international institutions with which the United States hasn't been in full agreement and which the US has often proven unwilling to join. Now, the Trump administration's ambivalence towards international institutions is a continuation more than a break, I think, with previous U.S. administrations. Yes, he's pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, he's pulled out of the UN Human Rights Council, he's pulling out of the World Health Organization, but previous American administrations have done somewhat similar things. George W. Bush withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Crisis Treaty in the early 2000s and on signed the Rome Treaty, which was creating the International Criminal Court. The Bush Senior and Clinton administrations indeed rejected a number of major international security agreements, like the conventions banning landmines, cluster munitions, and so on. So again, As I think we've been saying, we are looking perhaps at exacerbation of a trend or a continuation of a theme more than a radically new situation. What is different, I would say, with Trump, you could argue, is a more erratic and a more directly hostile approach to international diplomatic processes. I think the US at present is suffering from a rather catastrophic failure of leadership, not just internationally, but domestically as well, and from a lack of a broader strategic direction, which is clearly hampering its ability to be a reliable international partner, let alone a credible supplier of global leadership. Will that change in November? Well, if Biden takes over the White House, then clearly that may mean a return of the US to the diplomatic table. But I think it would be fanciful to think that it would lead to a radical reversal of America's position towards major international organizations. Just as the Obama administration didn't represent a radical reversion of Bush's foreign policy, a Biden administration would also not dramatically reverse the increasingly, if you will, skeptical stance towards multilateral organizations that we've seen by the US for many years now.
Ian, what do you think about the impact of the Trump presidency on America's global role?
He's an extreme example, but he is recognizable in American history. His instincts, which are managed to combine a degree of isolationism with randomized aggression, that's not unknown in American history. The leadership period that I would venerate from Truman through, from the Truman Doctrine onwards, is not necessarily standard American policy. There's always a contest or an argument in America about what its role in the world is. And America had started backing away long before Trump became president. What I don't see is any sign yet, and I know that the Biden team has its work cut out just winning the presidency, which is difficult enough. I don't see any early indications that there is a coherent foreign policy narrative or machinery developing. Of course, he will be appointing people and we'll hear about them in the next few weeks and months. Say he wins, what does a Biden presidency then look like in foreign policy terms? There'll be a sigh of relief from lots of people and lots of predictable responses, and people, and he'll be more polite, and he'll probably pivot towards Merkel instantly because that's just what you do, and she seems to represent good leadership in the crisis. For all I have reservations about her, but that doesn't really get you anywhere longer term, because Merkel's completely conflicted on China, which is going to be the challenge for whoever is the next American president, is how do you think about China and how do you respond intelligently? He won't find the answer with Merkel or with the EU more broadly, which is divided on what to do about China, driven by the need to revive exports and keep China on side, which is not really where American policy is going to be. A friend of mine who was in the early stages of the crisis was in Washington touring around the security and foreign policy establishment. What he was struck by most was that everyone, Democrat and Republican, and very often Democrats, were more hawkish on China. Everyone was anti-Chinese Communist Party. Everyone had an analysis that this is the big problem of the next 10 to 20 years. Not a single person he encountered, lots of them with much experience, had a program or a prescription about how to deal with it in practical terms. Now, one of the beauties of American politics is that even if the presidency is a lame duck, or worse than that, in Trump's case, an answer still emerges, usually out of Congress. So if you look at Congress at the moment, it's a competition between both parties to produce legislation and measures and sanctions which are as anti-Chinese Communist Party as possible. So you can see this, you can see the formulation of an American response to China coming not really from the White House at the moment, but coming from the other parts of the Constitution, the other parts of Washington. What that turns into, I don't know. For a state like Britain, or for another member of Five Eyes, the intelligence network, that poses really interesting, complex questions about where you sit and position yourself. Personally, I think that you'll see a reorientating of the West around that. And I think that Five Eyes network is a really good place to look and to think about something else being born. And policy, which will be, you'll need more than one policy circle. So if you're Britain, you obviously have an incredible, the Brits have an incredibly close working relationship with the French on security and intelligence and defence, where we operate as one in many respects now. Very close relationship with Australia and Canada and New Zealand, the other members of Five Eyes. Big question mark for everyone in the Five Eyes network is India. But where will India end up in relation to China? Probably reluctant to join what we think of as the old West, but might, because of Chinese aggression, be heading in that direction. So it's very difficult for Western policymakers to think through, very difficult, because there isn't yet an American position. There isn't an American leader, really, but there isn't yet an American policy position either. So all of this, I suspect, will be forged in the next 18 months to 2 years, a bit like American policy was remade and forged in 46, 47, 48, as Truman's analysis of how the world was developing shaped policy for the next 30 or 40 years.
So we are seeing a world in which the strategic rivalry between the United States and China has become a major part of global politics. What I want to ask you, Mehta, is do you think that we're likely to see our global order roughly split into pro-Washington and pro-Beijing networks of alliances in the coming years? Is this now the key dividing line in global politics?
No, I don't actually think so. In part because, due to some of the reasons that Ian just laid on the table, I think there isn't a clear enough agenda or set of policy solutions in Washington for other states to back up around and for there to be a stable coalition. The West is not ready to regroup, as he put it, partly also, I think, because of not just because there aren't clear policy solutions on the table, but because of the amount of trust, frankly, that has been squandered in the last 4 years. And I think here it's really important to remember that 4 years is both a long and a short time in global politics. What it has meant is that even though the next 18 months may see a much clearer articulation of American policy with respect to China, European countries are going to be reluctant and careful in how they buy into that and what kinds of new alliances they're willing to forge. Frankly, because trust is not just about who is in office, and working relationships are not just about who is in office currently in the US. 4 years down the line, we could be seeing American voters return a Trump-like figure to the White House, and we have seen a Republican Party who has proven unwilling and unable to restrain a president like that. And I think that has done greater amount of long-term damage, perhaps, than we're even to the Western alliance, than is perhaps apparent to many people right now. So I don't think we are going to see a hard crystallization. And as Ian also said, India and other players are in many ways between the poles currently. I also don't think it is clear that China is as strongly belligerent as this picture would suggest. Yes, China is increasingly willing to throw its weight around in international organizations like the World Trade Organization, the IMF, to build institutional alternatives like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Banks. But none of this, I think, amounts to a belligerent behavior as such. Jinping's rule has meant a hardening and increasing totalitarianism. But since we're talking about COVID here, I think it's important to point out that the pandemic represents the perhaps most critical legitimation challenge to his rule so far. The same is true, of course, in the US, so that neither the US nor China right now seem poised to emerge on the international scene as winners from this in terms of either their soft or their hard power.
I think what you both seem to be saying is that, again, we're realizing that the world is perhaps more complicated than certain people in policymaking positions thought it was, that we have actually a multipolar global order, and that's going to be what will shape current affairs moving forwards. So if we are broadening our vision beyond the US-China rivalry, I wanted to ask you both, what are the new threats and new challenges that we haven't necessarily been focused on during the pandemic, but which will come to define global politics in the coming years?
Good question. I think the other thing to mention is that none of this will be happening, Jack, in a domestic vacuum. The focus post-crisis, of course, policy elites and occasionally electorates will care about global politics and the alliances and what we've just been talking about. But it's likely that the focus will become increasingly domestic, particularly in countries that have had a rough crisis and have done badly. So in a country like the UK, which has had a very tough crisis, Italy as well, but focus on the UK just for a second, there will be a lot of soul searching about the model of public services, how robust the state's response was, how could it be better? Are we moving into living in an era of pandemics over the next 10, 20 years? How do you insulate yourself? How do you have to not only shorten your global supply chains for business, but you have to do that for healthcare as well? So you'll see simultaneously, as well as this new world is being formed, our experience since the Second World War, or even before that, is borrow to build, borrow to prop up the private sector, just pure instinct, having written a lot about financial crises and having been through several of them and interviewed a lot of people trying to find out what shapes them and why they happen. And they very often happen when there's a consensus about the world and about the way that money is operating and politics is operating at any given particular moment, as there was in the run-up to 2007. The consensus now, it's not full MMT, you know, modern monetary theory, but the consensus, emerging consensus, is you don't need to worry about debt because there's a limitless amount of it, rates are very low, therefore the responsibility of all Western states who've been getting hammered by the crisis in a way that, you know, numbers that are off the charts in terms of our experience since the Second World War, or even before that, is borrow to build, borrow to prop up the private sector, borrow to remake social care, borrow to do, well, you name it. I mean, borrow to save the arts, borrow to build the arts. And the number keeps on getting bigger. You know, if you said at the start of this year, let me show you a scenario in which Britain's deficit rises to 300 billion. Right. If we'd had that conversation in January, you'd have said, you're insane. There's nothing short of a nuclear war is going to prompt that, or a pandemic, which has just happened. And I'm not predicting that that turns into an inflation spiral. But the thing I'm most worried about, perversely, is the public finances and the threat for some unpredictable event. I mean, we've just lived for people to be saying now, relax about debt. What could possibly go wrong after we've just been, you know, sideswiped by the most extraordinary or blindsided by this pandemic event, I think is, at least I just put a question mark next to it. So I would worry about public finances and I would worry about the banking system because of the way in which they're intimately connected. I would worry particularly about the European banking, about the banking system, which was frail going into this. And I know there are optimistic people who say, don't worry, relax, there's enough money around, there's more money than we could ever need. But so I'm worried about money.
Meta, you have the last word. What are the great challenges for global politics coming up on the horizon?
There is one challenge to global politics that eclipses any other challenge, and it is, of course, climate change. That remains the overwhelming challenge to humanity at the moment and for the foreseeable future. And I think here it's interesting to note the close similarities and indeed the close interdependencies, of course, between the pandemic and the background challenge, if you will, of climate change. There is the danger that the pandemic is causing people to take their eyes off the ball and causing some measures to deal with climate change, both prevention and mitigation, to slip into the background. But at the same time, you could take an optimistic view and say that the COVID pandemic is bringing home a lot of the lessons that we should have been drawing a long time ago. It is bringing into sharper focus what we already knew were very significant problems, for instance, with the safety of and the resilience of global supply chains. So climate change activists have been warning for decades that global supply chains are uniquely vulnerable to climate change related disruption, weather, changing weather patterns, natural catastrophes, and very little have been done to address that. People have said, relax, it'll probably be okay. Well, we know now that it will definitely not be okay. And so I suppose a very optimistic reading would be that we can learn something from the pandemic, both about the acuteness of the dangers we're facing, but also about some of the tools that we do have at our disposal to try to address some of those challenges. Ian mentioned that another theme that I think we should just pull up briefly, which were the effects domestically, if you will, of the international financial crisis and how many people began to feel differently about the financial advantages of big global capital and global elites. And I think the COVID crisis, to some extent, is another such instance where we are seeing brought into sharper relief the inequalities of the system that we live under. The crisis, we're talking about winners and losers in a global context, but as very often with international politics, the real fault lines between winners and losers run domestically, where the crisis has exacerbated existing racial and socioeconomic inequalities. In this respect, I think we've seen that different countries have, nobody has coped well with the crisis so far, but different types of government, different types of domestic regimes have proven more or less capable of dealing with the crisis so far. Germany, the Scandinavian countries, New Zealand have overall performed better than populist regimes such as the US under Trump, or Brazil, where democratic decline and authoritarian tendencies have made decision makers less receptive both to scientific advice, but also, frankly, just to considering long-term public health interests. So an optimistic reading would be that the crisis has served to delegitimize, to some extent, populist regimes and perhaps re-legitimize the role of the state and of public policy in driving economic activity, and that will in turn re-equip us with some tools to address the other challenges we're facing, such as a shaky financial system and indeed climate change.
Well, on that nice optimistic note, that's all we have time for today. Meta and Ian, thank you very much. Next episode, we'll be joined by Helen Thompson and Matthew Karnichnik, who will be talking about the future of the European Union.